哎呀呀嘿呀嘿呀呀嘿呀呀呀嘿呀嘿，哎呀呀嘿呀嘿呀呀嘿呀呀呀嘿呀嘿。
Elder Voices, a window to the past, a door to the future.
Ay, 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 hey, ay, ay, hey.
My name is Dan Carmen. I was born in Deering in 1927. I lived there until about 1942 when gold mining closed down. I usually came down here to Nome to work just annually during summer. It was really a time in which slowly times were beginning to change, and our lifestyle in the village was always listening to mom and dad or the elders of the community in anything that we do, because it was always a message from the parents, the elders, on how to succeed in hunting, fishing, or anything of that nature. I would start with spring, let's say around May, when the ice first begins to break up on the ocean. It's a time when our people that depended on the large bearded seal, which we call the Ugruk. I remember our parents brought us down about 3 miles out of Deering to a location where it's quieter. And them days, there was hardly any planes that came into the villages. And the hunting was always more successful because there was no planes to scare the bearded seal. I remember my dad taking his Eskimo sled and his kayak and went out the ocean where perhaps the beach ice would be solid, but beyond that, maybe a couple of miles, it would be scattered where the Ugruks would be on top the ice, and he would hunt wherever it was ideal to go after an Ugruk. And they're always on top the ice when the sun is shining. They're always out there to get their own suntan, I believe, in that time. And they're much tamer when the sun is shining real well. And that is when Father would get out there and use the kayak to get a little closer to them and shoot the Ugruks. Then after getting several, he would get back to his sled and perhaps had three, four, well, I'd say about five dogs, not to have a big dog team out there because he wanted to be safe where he can, you know, get out there and back. And then he would bring in the Ugruks up to the camp. And that's where Mother would begin the process of skinning and opening the innards and taking them out. I remember my only sister would be there, and she would help out in doing this butchering of the Ugruk. Once the family on my mother's side got everything open, you would have to take the blubber away and the skin away from the meat. But they would hang the meat in order to get them dried up. Then usually the blubber and the skin is laid out there real open where the sun can dry the top, where you'd have a base where you could hold on to the blubber, because blubber is real slippery once you have it out there. So they would take about 2-3 days to dry the top of the blubber. And that's the way they'd done it. Once that's done, Mother would cut off the blubber, place it in them days was a seal skin that was caught during the springtime and dried up where they could become useful when Father got Nugruk. And she would place the blubber in the sealskin and always kept in a place where the sun didn't shine on it directly. There's always care that you need to take. If you had that blubber out in open and sun shining out, it could be a means of poisoning yourself because the sun would shine on it and spoil it. So it's always placed in a cool place so that it can, you know, become seal oil. Then, of course, Mother is always busy on the meat. Once you dry up a certain portion of the meat, they have the chore of opening and splitting it open until that portion of meat from the shank is drying up. They would open it up till it was about a quarter of an inch thick, and that was the way they took care of the meat as it dried up. Then once the meat is all dried up, they'd place it in the seal poke. That was the container for a number of things that they made use of the young seal that was caught during the springtime. Once that's put away, then the fishing season comes upon us. During the time the Ugruk meat is drying and Mother and Father is taking care of everything where it can become cut up and stored in the seal pokes. And it's during that period when Mother goes out to pick greens during the process of spring and summer coming into being. Picking greens, where we call it the surah in Eskimo. It's really vitamin rich, and picked surah during spring when they're growing up from a certain type of willows. Then, of course, besides surah, we would pick musu, that's roots that's grown underground. When the season is, you know, warm, it makes the musu grow. It's a root that grows underground. And it goes good with the surah and the masu, whichever way you want it to be put away, you know. So that's the way we done it then. After doing that, then the fishing season comes around. As soon as the ice is broken during that process, the whitefish come in and some trout as well. And I remember we would have the chore of going out to seine the whitefish and catching them. And Mother would cut up the whitefish in a certain way, dried it up, and there would be part of our meals during winter. Then, of course, after the first fishing season of whitefish, we would also go out and wait for the salmon would come in after the whitefish. And salmon is always either by setting a net near a river, or we could get out there and seine at the mouth of the river to catch them all at once. We can probably fill a boat of maybe 1,000 fish that you can put in the boat and just place them at the back of the house. And during that time, we'll certainly do a few other things in making sure the Ugruk meat is drying properly. And like I said, Mother is always there to open up the meat and continue to have it dry more. So it's a process that you'd be surprised how much work there is in taking care of the Ugruk meat, you know. And certainly it's a time where the whole family can learn, especially from the young girls in the family side, about cutting and storing. And that it's a good education process where they can take over when Mother gets too old and passes on where it's passed on to either side, the men, the young boys, that can go out and hunt after you're 13 years old. I remember when I turned 13, my brothers took me down to Cape Espenberg, that's out of Deering, to hunt seal while the ice is on, because that's where our seal pokes as containers to use when we have all the ugruk meat dried. And I remember my first time out there, my older brother said, "You cook some breakfast while we get out and hunt some seal." I said, "Okay." So I cooked breakfast. I got some water from the sea, the ocean, and cooked it, and I put more salt in it. I remember when they came here to the tent, they couldn't eat it because I used salt water. One of the big lessons that we kind of learn as we grow up, when they expect us to do things. And they laughed and said, "We can't eat your cereal here. We'll just have to go without it, I guess." And that is one of the first lessons I learned about trying to take care of your older brothers. And we got enough seals. Then we went back to Deering. It was about, I'd say, about 60 miles down towards Shishmaref. And they brought me out to the open water, where the open water is where we catch the seals. And I shot my first seal and brought it home. You know, you have great pride in catching something for the first time. And I thought I would be able to keep it. And I kept telling the young people in my age group, "Well, I got a seal." I told them I was so proud. But my mother and father told me, "Son, you got to bring your first catch to an elder in a community." And that's what I had to do, rather than keeping it. And I brought it to an elderly couple, and that lady, who was an elder, said in Eskimo, "May God bless you with many more." And that was the custom of our people. On a young man for the first time catching something, is always a practice to give it to someone else so that we'll be blessed with many more during your lifetime. And I found that out, that certainly that's one of the best things that a young man can do, because I've lived my life in raising a family, and we've always depended on those resources as we were growing up as a family, that it was there, and God certainly blessed, you know, the product that you caught. So after fishing, and everything is put away, the fishing is there now, where we have to take care of the fish. If you don't, then it could mold up if you don't turn it over. And that was always the chore of the kids in the family. And we always done it and watched it real careful. Then if we needed to build a fire underneath the cache to keep the flies away from it so they don't have all the bugs that grew on them. And that was always the chore of the young boys in the family. And the girls had certain things to do to take care of the products as well. And everyone in the family was told to do certain things, whether it's a girl or a boy. They expounded to them, "This is what you're going to do, son, and this is what you're going to do, daughter." And we were always told how to do it. And that's the way we succeeded in life and growing up to be men and women. I think one of the things that we kind of learned as young people was they always told us to help anyone in the community, whether it be another native or if it's a white person from the gold mining camps, to be helping them out or having them have a cup of coffee in the house. We were taught to be kind. It was always a good time. I think I recall more so the way that we done things was a means of keeping us healthy. The food that we took was a natural food from the sea, the land, and from the air. It's always a healthy diet that we have year-round. The berry picking time usually comes in around August, September. We'd go and pick blueberries, then blackberries, salmon berries. That was the series of berries that we have. I remember during the summer or towards fall, we'd pick the nest of a mouse out in the grassy country. We call it a little black root that's about the size of your smaller finger and very tasty. And what we would do, we would pick what they stored underground, then we would replace it with some dry fish, always exchanging with the product that you pick from another source. And I remember that so well because our parents said, don't you take that food and not replace it with something. We were always told to share, and that was the custom of our native people to share with one another. Then come fall time, when the ice first forms in the community, any community, there's always ice fishing, either for tomcod, the trout, or grayling in the river systems where ice is available and you punch holes on ice and start fishing. And I remember going up the river from Deering to do some trout and grayling fishing. We'd have a little open water in the river and we'd use a gas light in the evening to look at fish. They're always a little tamer when we go out with a gas light and shine on it and use a spear to catch the fish. You could be busy all year round. There's no time that you can stay too idle, you know. In the fall time, either you could do it as a young person, young man, or young lady who wants to get out and do something different. We'll set snares for ptarmigans or for rabbits. And that's what we've done during fall time as the snow and ice starts to form. And that's when our fathers would go out in the country, get their dog teams and go out camping and start trapping for foxes, wolverines, and do a lot of hunting. I remember my father being out, soon as it freezes and it's safe to travel, he would get out and get some foxes before Christmas, and a lot of the villagers would do that in order to be able to buy gifts come Christmas. Then I remember my father going near the timber country and would come home before Christmas and bring in a couple of trees. It would be he or some others, they would all agree that they'll bring a tree down for the school or the church. There's always means of working together. We didn't compete with another. We'd tell each other, you know, where there's good trapping, good hunting, so that all will succeed in being able to give presents to the family and others as well. My parents had 14 children, but you know, some would pass on because of illnesses. And them days, back in the 20s and 30s, it was always that each family would have so many children, you know, because the children are a means of help when they're hunting or fishing. And they always had a good number of children them days. I remember back then, church going was always a part of the community. Sundays, our parents would tell me as a young man to get out, fill the ice tank. Then my sister would be required to wash clothes, before Sunday, cleaned the house, mopped the floors. It always brought a means of satisfaction and peace on Sunday when we see all the things that we don't have to do. We'll head for church and honor the Sabbath day. In 1942, I think it was, when a good buddy of mine, we came down to Nome. That was when the military was building sites here in Nome. I came 2 seasons during the summer to find work because gold mining had closed, and during it there was no work available. And having a family that was growing, I would come down to Nome and worked either for what they call the United States Smelting, Refining, and Mining Company, either there or with the Bureau of Public Roads, working on the road system. The 3rd season I came down here, there was Mr. Walsh, Pete Walsh, who was the manager for Wayne Alaska Airlines. And he told me that if I wanted to work for the summer, I could. He said it would be just for the summer. I said, okay, I'll do that. But about middle of the summer, there was another young man in the company that got drafted into the military service. And I took his place and stayed in Nome ever since. I got that job and stayed with him 16 years, so I moved the family, the entire family down. We had 4 children then. And this was first time we ever experienced being in a school system where high school is available. And my wife and I certainly made every effort to get them kids to go complete high school, and which they did. We had one, however, that dropped out, but we got him to go through GED, you know. And that's something we never experienced in the village. Way back in the 1930s, some villagers would go to White Mountain for high school. I remember my brother went down there, but I didn't go. The extent of my education was 8th grade. But the education I had from my parents and the elders in the community was the only thing that kept me going, respecting everything, you know, that I was taught. And that's what my wife and I kind of carried on. I know a lot of children in the villages as well were taught the same thing. And they live by it in order to be in harmony with kindness to anyone that they met. So that was a thing that, you know, tried to carry on here in the community. I remember my wife had to go to the sanatorium down at Seward for tuberculosis. And I was just a young man, not caring very much about strict standards of a family, you know. My mother had to babysit the 4 kids we had. And I'll never forget that, you know, I used to go to town quite often without any thought of caring for the kids. Mother was doing it. But I'll never forget the things that are expounded in the church about how we as parents are examples for any kids that grows in a family. And I thought I was hiding well enough where they don't recognize what I was doing. But I'll never forget, as a parent, after my wife was hospitalized, that the 4 kids we had grabbed empty bottles, staggered around, and said, "I'm Dad." Boy, it really got me. Our neighbors were the church that was first established in Nome back in the 40s. And I decided, well, I'm going to have to change my habits, I guess, since the kids kind of showed me my disregard for bringing them up in a good way that should be taught as a parent. And that's what I done. Then about 2 months later, after telling me that they're like me. After 2 months of going to church, they done the thing in grabbing a songbook, a church songbook, and a Bible. And they said, I'm dad. It was a change. And I think that happens in any family unit, you know, where we need to be so careful in bringing up our families, because a young child knows what we're doing, even though they cannot speak about the things we as parents are doing. But that was a lesson I learned, and I'm glad I'm making that change along with mother and the four kids going to church more often. I think it's something with this modern day and age we live in, is something that needs to be looked at so carefully. I grew up with the reindeer herders families. When my father got married to my mother, that's mother-to-be, my father had earned some reindeer at Wales and drove his reindeer he earned from Wales to Deering. And I don't know what number it was. I found that out in updating a couple of U.S. government reindeer diaries. Lo and behold, I saw my father's name, father-to-be, name in driving his deer from Wales to Deering. And I think from 1916 on, my father was really involved in having the first herd up to that particular country. Back there, I remember dog teaming in reindeer herding, not realizing that it was my father's herd. You know? We would do our corralling about 60 miles southeast of Deering, where their timber is. We would go up there every winter, and the families of the community would move out of Deering to attend the reindeer handlings. Whether they had any children in the community, they would pull out and pull their children out to go up reindeer herding. And I think I was one of them as well. It was a means of learning how to reindeer herd. It was taught to different families. It was a means to earn reindeer meat, the byproducts of reindeer, the sinew, the reindeer leggings, the reindeer skin that was used for either making mukluks, parkies, or a means of having a mattress out of the reindeer skin. There's been a lot of changes I've noticed. I worked with the reindeer industry for 13 years, with 5 years with Koerik, then 8 years with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and saw a great change. When I was growing up, my mother and father, who administered the reindeer herding day in, day out, that's when the reindeer became so domesticated than they are today, because they stayed with them day in, day out in raising the reindeer herds. Their reindeer would be around the camp where they would move about for feeding the reindeer herds in different locations. And it was much easier to reindeer handle, and that was the only source where the villages can depend on a few dollars that they can earn back there, then of course the byproducts, which they would demand more than they would the cash, because it provided clothing and everything. They always depended on those, that resource, when attending reindeer handlings. Of course, the younger generation that are herders today haven't carried out that practice. I think I would blame that matter on the reindeer herders of a younger generation that did not get out and care for the reindeer. It provided the dollars, the byproducts. Unfortunately, the villagers, most of the villagers, you know, did not demand that because they lived with the changes in life. think it's a practice that needs to be revived if our current generation of Inupiaq people are going to survive. They're going to have to put back into practice those things that our parents and elders taught us when we were growing up. And that's more so in the villages, because a lot of the villages still do a lot of sewing of mukluks and other things that are native. I think one of the things that we need to reintroduce in the villages and native community is the kazge, where the menfolks met quite often as they were growing up. You know, where the menfolks taught the young generation of boys that were growing up the things that are required to succeed. Then, of course, the women folks had their meetings as well, you know, on teaching the young ladies on what to expect as, you know, future mothers, and learning how to sew and keeping a family going. And I think it's something that we need to closely look at, on how to revive those things that our elders and parents succeeded on. It's something that we need to kind of look at real close. And hopefully the villagers or any regional village can revive those things where we can succeed as a family unit.
You've been listening to Elder Voices, a production of KNOM.
If you are an elder or know an elder who would like to participate, call KNOM at 907-443-5221 or write to KNOM Radio, Elder Voices, P.O. Box 988, Nome, Alaska, 99762. Thank you for listening to Elder Voices.